The Second Crusade has failed, but its end will open the door to the Plantagenets, that brilliant, avaricious, rebellious, murderous family that will dominate the history of Western Europe for a century to come. Here's their story, so riveting that we still are fascinated by it 900 years later.
Welcome back to Lion's Forge. My name is Beckett, and I want to tell you a story, an epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 2, Episode 17, Dynastic Luck. In 1177, Henry had needed a suitable boon to mark 11-year-old Prince John's alliance with the powerful FitzRobert family, whose desirable lands, hard on the Welsh border, provided enough wool, leather, forged iron, and dried fish to make the Earls very wealthy men. Henry had accordingly named his youngest son the ruler of Ireland, a relatively new Plantagenet possession. Ireland was an interesting place, with a history that could be taken as both an echo of Eleanor and Henry's one-time passion and a sobering story about the national consequences of overheated sexual chemistry. The chronicler Gerald of Wales, admittedly not the most reliable journalist of his day, wrote that the whole story of the English in Ireland began when an Irish prince left his wife behind while he went adventuring. The lady apparently took advantage of her husband's absence by allowing herself to be beguiled, and it seems more than merely beguiled, by a rival lord named Dermot MacMurrough. The result was a war among the Irish chieftains, unpleasant but expected, since, as Gerald blandly observed, almost all of the greatest evils in the world have arisen from women. MacMurrough, who was losing at war, if not at love, ultimately went to Henry for help, which took the form of permission for MacMurrough to recruit willing volunteers from among the Plantagenet barons. A down-on-his-luck aristocrat named Richard de Clare, nicknamed Strongbow, read the letter with interest. De Clare had problems stemming from Henry's old grudge over de Clare backing King Stephen instead of Henry's mother Matilda during the anarchy. Ireland would give Strongbow a fresh start. He led a small army onto the Irish coast, beat back MacMurrough's enemies, married MacMurrough's daughter, and was named the heir to MacMurrough's kingdom. Over the next several years, he'd go on to defeat an Irish army under Rory O'Connor, powerful king of the West Country, setting the Norman English firmly at the summit of the ruling aristocracy of Ireland. Henry hadn't paid all that much attention to the island, too busy with his other holdings. But once the awful spectacle of December 29, 1170 was splashed across the cathedral floor at Canterbury, Henry wanted an escape from the horrified scrutiny of the civilized world. It so happened that just about then, Strongbow was settling rather too comfortably in the role of master of the island. Accordingly, early in 1171, a few months after Thomas Becket's death, Henry brought his own army to the Irish coast and marched to Dublin, ultimately declaring himself Lord of Ireland. The move, bolstered as it was by papal approval, was generally accepted quietly, making Henry's only visit to the country less dramatic than his norm. Indeed, little happened there from Henry's perspective for some years. By 1177, half a decade after Henry's intervention, Strongbow had died, and Henry had a new option with which to grace his youngest son. It would, by the way, turn out to be John's most enduring title. He would be Lord of Ireland for some 40 years, more than twice as long as he'd wear the crown of the King of England. Henry's success in Ireland meant that he had no rivals whatever in the British Isles. Plantagenet control on the continent, whether direct, as in Normandy, or through sworn vassals, as in Toulouse and Saxony, now extended across the better part of France and into the territory of the Holy Roman Emperor. It's interesting to us, knowing Napoleon and Hitler, that Henry never tried to go further or to dominate more. He could have turned aggressively on Louis Capet, but he never tried. One historian remarked that the two were like the United States and Soviet Union of the Cold War era. Restless, edgy rivals perpetually trying to set each other back, fighting proxy wars that spent each other's treasure, while equally careful to negotiate tolerable compromises at every opportunity. The two would sign an oath in 1177 that set it out quite clearly.
"We wish all men to know that we are now and intend henceforth to be friends, and that each of us will, to the best of his ability, defend the other in life and limb, and in worldly honor against all men."
"I, Henry, will aid my lord Louis."
"And I, Louis, will aid Henri, my vassal."
Henry and the French would still squabble over territory, often prodded by other alliances. But the master of the Plantagenet world never moved to conquer the Capets. As one historian wrote of him, "He seems never to have tried to free himself from his feudal obligation to a sovereign far inferior to him in wealth and power." Vassals could, and did, rebel against their lords any day of the week. But Henry's forbearance was based on some very rational thinking. Attacking a king who also happened to be his liege might put ideas into others' heads that were better left alone. Besides, he was not entirely an arrogant Norman. There was Angevin blood in his veins, and the Angevins had long displayed what had been described as rather ostentatious loyalty to the Capets. And no matter how titanically energetic the man was, no matter how well run his government, no matter how much money was gathered into his treasuries, there was a limit to the scope of 12th century administrative competence. Even nearby Ireland would rarely see a Plantagenet in the flesh. Maintaining what he already had was realistically about as far as Henry could reach, and he was smart enough to know it. As for Louis, he never seemed to hold a grudge over their stinging little wars, rarely unwilling to be persuaded back into affability with the man he often called his most dear brother. Take the ongoing scandal of Louis's daughter Alice, now commonly rumored to be Henry's latest mistress. Even the Pope was so distressed by the very real appearance of sin that he threatened Henry with an interdict on his continental lands if he didn't proceed immediately with the 17-year-old princess's wedding to her longtime fiancé, Prince Richard, now 20. Somehow, Henry talked his way out of it, getting Louis to agree that Elise would continue life at Henry's court, still unmarried. People had to be gossiping after a cup or two of wine that Henry must be sleeping with his son's woman, along the lines of the equally common belief that Henry's father had bedded Eleanor before Henry married her. As for the noble fiancé, handsome, ruthless Richard, he was off fighting in the Aquitaine, entirely indifferent to the lures of married life. As Louis Capet aged, his interest in the things that enthralled Henry faded. He turned increasingly toward the life of his soul, fasting, meditating, walking the walled gardens of local monasteries, dining with monks rather than ministers. Whether Louis really was what was described at the time as a sovereign far inferior to the English king, one measure was unarguable. He had only one son, Philippe Dieudonné. In 1179, to Louis's horror, his 13-year-old heir became separated from his friends during a hunting trip in the monumental forest of Compiègne. Stumbling around in the wet, dark chill of that awful night, the prince came down with a spiking fever. Legend says that however many royal servants frantically searched for him, he was rescued by a peasant, who found him while carrying a little kettle filled with warm coals, a happenstance that may have saved the boy's life. Even so, when the palace surgeons finally got to him, he was thought mortally ill. His terrified father dreamed that Thomas Becket, the Saint Louis had long protected in life, assured him that Philip would recover if Louis visited the Canterbury Shrine. No French king had ever set foot in England. Indeed, aside from John the Good, an involuntary guest who would be conveyed in chains several centuries later, no other French king ever would. Louis Capet, however, who'd gone crusading in his day, would be the one to go to England, trusting that his pilgrimage would save his only son. Henry Plantagenet met his ship at Dover and rode with him to Canterbury, where both kings spent 3 days fasting and praying together. It would be the last time Henry and Louis, linked throughout their long and eventful lives, would ever see each other. On the fourth day of his pilgrimage, Louis went home, where he learned that his son's fever had broken, just as Thomas had promised in the dream. But what happened next was equally bad. Either on the trip or very soon after arriving in Paris, Louis was stricken with some form of paralysis. Now the old king was the one thought mortally ill by surgeons, who soberly shook their heads over his bedside. Louis had already begun planning his son's coronation in the French manner, where the heir was crowned before the father's death. His belief that he was dying made the old king even more intent on the great celebration. The date was set for All Saints' Day, November 1, 1179, at the Cathedral of Reims, one of the most sacred sites in France. Clovis, the first man to claim kingship of all the Frankish tribes, had been baptized at Reims 700 years before, along with 3,000 of his men, one of the seminal events in European Christianity. Virtually every noble and every high churchman of France was in attendance at Philip's coronation. Rank upon rank of princes, barons, duchesses, abbots and bishops, and all their attendants, the throng dressed in the finest wools and wondrous furs, all the colors and designs of heraldry and dyer's skills displayed against the somber gray stone of the great church. The crowd must have been enormous. One report said that one noble guest brought 80 knights in his entourage. Young Henry, in his role as Duke of Normandy, and thus a key vassal of the French king, carried the French crown at the head of the procession. Poets sang hopefully of a springtime of peace opening the bosom of the earth. After the solemn rites, which apparently included the touching gesture of young Henry helping to support the prince's head as the heavy crown was lowered upon it, the guests swept out into the cold November air. The newly crowned boy king and his sworn liegemen gathered in their finery, young Philip paying particular attention to the comments of his mentor, Philip, Count of Flanders, the man who had carried the sword of state in the procession. We have to pay some attention to Count Philip ourselves, since he plays a role in medieval Western Europe for the next decade. How he got there was an interesting story that combined luck, timing, and a commanding personality. His country may have been small, but Flanders was important and rich, nestled as it was where the European coast rode closest to the ports of England. Its ability to turn English wool into woven cloth admired across the civilized world made it one of the very first manufacturing and exporting powerhouses in Europe. Nor were its water-driven looms its only distinction. Flemish mercenaries, well-equipped and well-trained, were considered among the best fighting men in the world. One of the rewards enjoyed by Flemish counts who could field these coveted armies was generous favor from both the Plantagenets and the Capets. The French had to think particularly hard about how Philip of Flanders might be kept close, since the count was something of a loose cannon. His country had been a longtime French ally, so much so that Louis Capet had asked the count to serve as guardian of precious young Prince Philip. After the near disaster in the forests of Compiègne, Count Philip had accompanied Louis to Canterbury to pray for the boy's recovery. That all certainly had a reassuring pro-Capetian ring to it, but there were complications. The count had spent time at Henry's court as a boy, admired the man, and had married none other than Eleanor's niece. The bride, whose name was Elizabeth, was the daughter of Eleanor's sister Alix and Raoul of Vermandois, that couple whose illicit passion for each other had launched a war decades before. What with one death and another, Elizabeth ended up inheriting Vermandois. The French now faced an unwelcome uncertainty as to how Flanders and Vermandois would vote if push came to shove between the Plantagenets and the Capets. So far, Count Philip had played a calming role in European politics, even trying to mend the unmendable breach between Henry Plantagenet and Thomas Becket. But the Count's true interest in life just now focused on family dynamics. His intimacy with the newly crowned French prince could yield a wealth of new opportunities. Most immediately, the heir to the French throne, a relatively elderly 14, was still unmarried. Count Philip just happened to have an unmarried female relative of the right age, his pretty 9-year-old niece Isabel of Hainaut. Isabel had more going for her than the passing charms of extreme youth. She was a direct descendant of Charlemagne, meaning that such a marriage would permit the Capetians to share the reflected luster of one of the greatest heroes of French history. All one had to do was ignore the fact that she was already promised to a member of the rival Blois dynasty, which at least some people were quite prepared to do. Her uncle, Count Philip, was one of those people. 2 months after Philip Dieudonné was crowned, the new year, 1180, launched an unsettled decade marked by unexpected deaths and sudden reversals of fortune's great wheel. Henry II lost one of his most loyal advisors when Richard de Lucy died. Then, Louis Capet entered his own treacherous last days, his health slipping down, his paralyzed legs getting weaker. As the old king edged further and further from the earthly world, Prince Philip became the de facto ruler of France, replaying the role his grandfather Louis le Gros had starred in as a teenager 90 years before. In recognition of his new status, we'll now call the young man Philip Augustus, the name he would eventually earn from French chroniclers. The jostling around the palace for the ear of this untried young monarch was intense. The Blois family in particular was on high alert. The prince's mother, Adèle of Champagne, was from the House of Blois, which was supposed to get Isabel of Hainaut and her inheritance, the territory of Artois, for itself. Artois was another of the splinters that made up what we now know as France, a coastal splinter just to the south of Flanders, which would enlarge Blois territory quite nicely. The Blois family's fuming irritation with Count Philip's machinations to see that she married a Capet instead increased by the day, reaching maximum volume at Easter 1180, when the Count won a resounding victory. Isabel married the heir to the French throne. The groom's mother was so stressed by the marriage that she fled from the side of her dying husband to plead with her brother Theodore, Count of Blois, to do something about this sudden precipitous decline in Blois fortunes. We do have to take a step back to note the tangle of relationships in which medieval nobility lived. stemming on the one hand from an intense preference for marrying someone at least as rich as you were, and on the other from the limited geographic scope of potential mates, not to mention issues of consanguinity. 12th-century family trees could easily take on the complexity of a 21st-century chemical compound. Theodore of Blois, for example, was married to Eleanor and Louis' younger daughter, Alix. Theodore's brother, the Count of Champagne, had married Eleanor and Louis' older daughter, Marie. In short, Blois brothers had married Capet sisters. This entire generation and its progeny, therefore, were simultaneously related to both the King of France and the Queen of England. Even a relatively ordinary member of the family could simultaneously claim kinship with French royalty, the Dukes of Aquitaine, and the House of Blois-Champagne. Another marriage or two could readily yield ties to Normandy and Anjou, the Plantagenet side of the clan. In theory, this was supposed to cut down on war among siblings and cousins, but it's fairly obvious that the theory was not terribly effective in practice. Getting back to the Blois family's distress at Prince Philip's marriage to Isabel, his uncle Theodore produced no brilliant strategic stroke to counter the marriage. But dynastic ill luck rarely failed to shower benefits on someone else. What the House of Blois lost was gained by the Capets, specifically Isabel's dowry, Artois, with its channel beaches. The French had always been blocked from the sea. Now, they suddenly had water frontage. What would prove Philip Augustus's own lifetime of good fortune had been duly launched. The frustrated House of Blois sent for help from the mediator of Europe, Henry Plantagenet. We tend to wonder why this worrisome French matter should involve Henry, but he agreeably made an appearance. He soothed Queen Mother Adele's distress under the centuries-old Gisors Elm, the spot in the Vexin where French kings and Norman dukes had buffed out their differences for generations. Henry was the patient, wise elder statesman to the battling group, ultimately offering to pay Count Philip 1,000 English pounds sterling a year in exchange for Flemish promises of peace with the Blois family. It was not an entirely one-sided deal. The Count agreed to provide Henry the services of 500 Flemish knights. There was little love lost between Henry and the Blois family, once his arch-rivals for the English throne. But he must have calculated that for now, the French and the Flemish were better off in his debt than not. Some 3 months later, as the summer of 1180 gave way to fall, Henry's sometime friend and constant rival, and Eleanor's former husband, Louis Capet, died at the age of 60. His son was 15. Once again, a teenaged boy had become the King of France. An early example of this young king's appetite for aggression occurred in the first lightning days of spring in the year 1182. When a seemingly minor player died, Count Philip's wife, Elizabeth of Vermandois. She was 40 years old and childless. As such, her lands, a thriving little place thanks to its fabrics and widely admired blue dyes, was in play. More importantly, it lay just to the northeast of the Île-de-France. Both Philips, young king and older count, reached out their hands to take it. So recently being the best of friends was something very quickly forgotten now that such desirable territory was at stake. The last time France had been ruled by a boy, it had happened almost a half century before, when Louis Capet came to the throne from life in a monastery. France had soon learned that it had never faced anyone like Henry Plantagenet. This time, in their turn, Henry Plantagenet and his sons would find that they had never faced anyone like Philip Augustus. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again July 22nd for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.